It's 5:06 and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later in the program, we'll meet a national reporter who's coming to Wisconsin to talk about what he calls media minefields in covering national security issues.
First, a new poll out today from the Wall Street Journal and NBC shows that more Americans are rethinking the role America should play on the international stage.
47% of Americans polled say that the United States should reduce its involvement in world affairs, a number that's up from previous decades. The poll comes at a time when the country's entangled in a handful of foreign policy challenges, including, but not limited to, a standoff with Russia, the negotiation of a nuclear deal with Iran, and troop withdrawal in Afghanistan.
So what's behind Americans' changing views on the subject, and is the trend likely to continue? Well, joining us now is Christopher Nichols. He's an assistant professor of history at Oregon State University, who studies the United States and its relationship to the rest of the world. Christopher, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So 47% of Americans surveyed say they think the country should pull back from the world stage. How big of a change is this?
It is not that big of a change over the last decade, but it's a pretty significant change since the Cold War. And in fact, the numbers are a little bit more stark if you look at some different polls. Pew Research Center polls in late 2013 and early 2014 indicate that 53% of Americans want the U.S. to mind its own business abroad.
So what do you think is driving these numbers? You said it's not necessarily that surprising given the trend of the last decade, but what's happened in that last decade?
Well, there was a brief blip around 2002, if you look at the poll data, where Americans really wanted the nation to be more active in the world. And that's sort of no surprise coming after 9/11. And since then, we've seen a precipitous incline in the numbers of Americans who want the U.S. to mind its own business. So it went from about 30% in 2002 saying the U.S. should mind its own business internationally to about 53% or 47%, depending on the poll you cite, today. So what's gone on? Well, certainly the U.S. is war-weary. We see that in poll after poll, and, you know, I think we see that on the streets. I see that with my students as well. And the pullback from Afghanistan, for example, most Americans who are polled say that's been going too gradually, in fact. There's still 33,500 U.S. troops as of April 1st in Afghanistan, and Americans are surprised and, I think, chagrined to see that that's still ongoing.
Now, President Obama, over the past months and years, has been talking about what he calls American exceptionalism. And part of that is this idea that the United States has an obligation to the rest of the world. Some people say the United States thinks of itself as the world's policeman. Do you think that Americans are still invested in that notion of American exceptionalism?
That's a great question. I think so. The problem of exceptionalism is that it's a little bit like beauty. It's in the eye of the beholder. What does that mean? What's the real content? The great philosopher William James would say that exceptionalism is something like an empty vessel, a specious abstraction, and we fill it with whatever we want. So it's a neat political tool of rhetoric to talk about exceptionalism. But what does that mean? So the poll data, I think, gestures towards what that indicates. And one interesting thing in the polls that just came out that we haven't paused to reflect on much yet is that most Americans, still a large majority, think the U.S. is, quote, the leading military power and the preeminent economic power. This is something like 68% of Americans poll that way. And related to that is a fear, also evidenced in polls, that the U.S. is now somehow less important and less powerful than 10 years ago, something like 53% of Americans. So I think the exceptionalist question and how to define it is wrapped up in a fear of decline, plus a sort of hubristic or arrogant or hopeful sense that the U.S. is a really strong military and economic power.
So meanwhile, 19% apparently say America should be more active around the globe. Where do you think that comes from?
That's interesting. Yeah, and I think this is what when President Obama recently has been defending his foreign policy in Manila, for example, a few days ago, was pushing back against critics like Bob Corker of Tennessee or John McCain of Arizona, making claims that his foreign policy, that the Obama administration's foreign policy has amounted to, quote, wrist slaps or something like leading from behind. And so that 19% of Americans really slot into that criticism that instead of being defensive or more balanced, the U.S. ought to be more active and interventionist.
Now, in terms of people who think that we really should be retreating from the world stage, maybe taking care of business at home, do you think this reflects on the economy right now, that there's a feeling of insecurity, a sort of certain powerlessness among certain people? Is that part of this as well?
Absolutely. You know, if you look back at this historically, some of the moments where the U.S. has turned somewhat more inward have been times when, given limited resources, American policymakers and citizens have really thought long and hard about the costs and consequences of being involved sort of very actively abroad. And here we could think first to the 1890s and turn of the 20th century. There was a vigorous series of debates about imperialism and anti-imperialism. People like William James and Jane Addams and W.B. Du Bois, all these figures came together and said the U.S. really needed to live up to its domestic aims and ideals, progressive reform, racial reform, women's suffrage, before going abroad and experimenting with empire. So the same thing you could say in the 1920s. Americans pulled back from some elements of world leadership, in the League of Nations, for example, while still being involved economically in a wide array of places to address sort of questions of democratic improvement and growth. And you could say the same thing again in the 70s after Vietnam. The U.S. was much more circumspect about its an interventionist foreign policy and turned inward to deal with stagflation and issues like that.
Well, President Obama's approval rating as far as foreign policy goes is 38%. That's the lowest it has been during his presidency. What does that signal, do you think?
Yeah, you know, I think there's a sort of weariness with President Obama and his policies more broadly. And I find certainly in this poll data, Americans and some of the anecdotes pulled out of the polls see Obama's foreign relations and sort of balanced approach as too wishy-washy. It's interesting when you sort of try to dissect the language of the polls, you find that Americans both approve of the balance in large amounts. Something like 42% approve of his balanced approach, depending on the situation, whereas something like 36% say he's too cautious. So I think we as citizens kind of want it both ways. Frankly, but that general perception is one of a kind of lack of leadership, at least in terms of foreign relations. And I think in part that's because Americans don't pay attention to the nuances of foreign relations very well. You know, President Assad in Syria's chemical weapons have now been handed over, 87% have now been handed over and or destroyed. That's could be depicted as a real win in diplomacy. But somehow Obama's critics have cast that as a kind of leading from behind, that's a Russian victory or something along those lines. We could say the same thing about the multilateral actions in Libya, for example, or not taking more robust action in the Ukraine.
Well, we're talking right now with historian Christopher Nichols about a new poll that shows growing support for America pulling back from the world stage. We're talking with historian Christopher Nichols about a new poll out today from the Wall Street Journal and NBC News. 47% of the poll's respondents say America should become less active in international affairs. And we want to know what you think. Are you in favor of the country scaling back its involvement abroad? Or do you think it's important that America continues to play a central role in world affairs? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And you can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. And let's go to our callers right now and take our first from Alan in Mineral Point. Hey, Alan.
Hello. Just real briefly, I believe that until we solve our own problems, economic, social, etc., we don't have a lot of leg to stand on to help the rest of the world. In addition, I this weekend discovered the fact that America's going to be spending over $80 billion on our armed forces this coming year, when the cost of sending every single American high school student to college next year would be around $60 billion. Maybe our money could be better spent elsewhere for our own economy and for our own good.
All right. Well, thank you for those thoughts, Alan. And Alan, reflecting what some people have said in response to the survey, that there's a lot of business that needs to be taken care of here at home, and that America maybe is spread a little thin abroad as well. And do you think that what we're hearing here, Christopher, is a sort of leaning toward a more isolationist mentality?
Yes, very much so, but not in the pejorative sense that isolationism so often is cast as, but rather a kind of, as Alan just mentioned, a sort of eyes wide open perspective on the ways in which the U.S. should and shouldn't be involved in the world and the sorts of pressing challenges confronting the federal government given limited resources. And again, this is a historical question as well. We see this very often. American policymakers, but particularly citizens, have said that there's sort of a quid pro quo here, right? You can afford only a certain amount of things for the U.S. One example right around a little bit after 9/11 was the first round of healthcare debates, where roughly the burn rate for the American military deployment in Iraq was the same amount as the cost for universal healthcare. Now, obviously, that's a sort of a false binary, but nevertheless, it really shows how Americans are thinking about these sorts of issues.
Now, you've thought some about isolationism, and you see it in a sort of complex way that, as you said, it's not necessarily a bad thing. How would you describe isolationism and the different ways that we can talk about it?
That's a great question. Yeah, so I think, you know, I've written a book about this, Promise and Peril, America at the Dawn of a Global Age, and a number of articles. And when you go back to the historical record, you find American intellectuals, activists, politicians, and citizens making arguments for a kind of cautious or circumspect role in the world that's often commercially and culturally engaged with the world, but argues for different perspectives on when, where, and why to deploy military or diplomatic force. And so over the last sort of 120 or so years, as the U.S. rose to great military and economic power, Americans have differed on this. But one of the ways that isolationism has sort of gotten a bad name is that, as George Bush put it in his 2006 State of the Union, that it counts as a kind of retreat within our borders and that it's a kind of naive way of looking at the world. But again, that sort of strips it of the real authentic, deeper questions involved, right? What are the nation's ideals? How should they be embodied in how the U.S. Goes abroad? And can those ideals be sort of performed and actuated if there's injustice at home or if there's economic hardship at home?
Well, let's go back to the phones right now. We've got Steve, who's joining us in Madison. Hi, Steve.
Yeah. One, I assume that withdrawal from U.S. or from world affairs excludes Israel, that we will maintain our strong support of Israel. But apart from that, if we withdraw from anywhere else, then China, as a growing industrial power, gets to take over without any conflict from us of all natural resources in Africa, all natural resources in South America, and so forth. So there's a great deal to be lost if we withdraw from the world, simply because other competing powers will take over and command control of the natural resources that are available.
Okay, well, thank you much for your thoughts, Steve. And Steve voicing something that's been said before, that power abhors a vacuum. So if there is one, it will be filled, and maybe not in a way the United States likes or that is in the best interests of our country or the world at large. What about that argument?
Right. Nicely put, Veronica. I mean, I think that's also a genuine challenge for policymakers and for citizens in trying to weigh this, the appropriate balance here. I think, though, that it's a little easy for us to depict that as a zero-sum game, right, that the U.S. somehow, quote, retreats, and therefore another power, another great power, presumably, moves in, right, as if there's some direct relationship there. Certainly, there can be one, but there doesn't have to be. And what the Obama administration has been arguing, and we could discuss and debate whether or not they've done it effectively, is that a more incremental approach designed around multilateral and shared world responsibility is a more appropriate vision for the 21st century moving onward, particularly given the questions of limited resources for the U.S. So, you know, even if power abhors a vacuum, perhaps a multiplicity of powers might be able to accomplish the same sorts of goals that a unilateral effort otherwise would be designed to do.
For President Obama and for politicians who might have their eye on 2016, what do you think is a takeaway from the poll here about what Americans may want from foreign policy going forward?
That's another really interesting point. So one thing that hasn't yet gotten much press from this poll is that Americans have, just in the last 6 years, begun to evidence a modestly increased desire for showing more strength abroad. So it went from about 48 or 50% of those polled in 2008 to 55 or 56% now saying that we need a president who will present an image of strength. And but that doesn't specify what type of strength, willingness to confront enemies abroad and stand up for our principles, perhaps. But what you know, what's the content there? And I think so. The poll indicates that something on the order of 48% of those surveyed saw Hillary Clinton as someone embodying that positively. And then there's a real split here. And again, we get back to isolationism or circumspect foreign policy in terms of what. Rand Paul represents. The split there was something like 23% saw him positively to 25% seeing him negatively. And so I wonder what these sorts of sentiments indicate in terms of foreign relations. I mean, Hillary Clinton, of course, as Secretary of State and a very much for an interventionist, internationalist foreign policy, perhaps more so than President Obama, is this positive response to her actually a repudiation of some of the other things being said in this very same poll? That's an open question for us, I think.
Christopher, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks very much for having me, Veronica.
We've been talking to Christopher Nichols, an assistant professor of history at Oregon State University.
There's always been a tension in media coverage of national security issues between the public's need to know and the government's desire to protect secrets.
Just this month, the Pulitzer Prize honored the Washington Post and the Guardian for publishing NSA data leaked by Edward Snowden, which New York Congressman Peter King called disgraceful. He said it would be like rewarding a paper for revealing secret plans for D-Day before the Normandy invasion.
Our next guest will tackle the ethics of national security reporting when he's in Wisconsin later this week. Eric Lichtblau reports on national security and other issues for the New York Times. He's speaking at the UW-Madison in a conference on surveillance, security, and journalism ethics. His keynote address is titled Media Minefields, Journalism, National Security, and the Right to Know. Eric, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, how often do national security reporters like you run into these media minefields?
Well, frequently, especially since 9/11, and surprisingly, especially during the Obama administration, which has been surprising because this is an administration that came in pledging transparency and greater openness, and has initiated more leak investigations than any administration in history, and almost all of those have centered on national security cases and the tension that you spotlight between the public's right to know and the government's intense interest in keeping secrets. So this is a frequent tripwire for Washington reporters, and we are editors are often in the situation of having to at a minimum field calls from the administration officials saying we wish you wouldn't run this story for reasons X, Y, and Z. But it's more than just a phone call. It's the threat of a subpoena. It's the threat of being dragged into a criminal investigation, and it's the threat of sources who have a lot to lose if they cooperate in reporting out stories.
Do reporters have an obligation to make sure their coverage doesn't endanger national security?
Sure, and I think that's a responsibility that we take seriously. At least I know at the New York Times, where I work, and colleagues at other papers do take that very seriously. And Congressman King's comment about printing the details of D-Day, I think makes for interesting rhetoric, but that's all it is rhetoric, because in fact, the types of details that papers are printing and TV networks are airing, whether it's from the Edward Snowden files or other stories, we are very careful about making sure that those are not compromising what the intelligence folks call sources and methods. I worked extensively on the package of stories from WikiLeaks that came out a couple of years ago, and the paper was meticulous about going through those and excising the names of sources, the names of people who might be compromised if their identities were out there publicly. There are often cases where we are going above and beyond what's necessary to make sure that compromising information should not be put out there. But at the same time, we think that the public does have a right to know, that we should not be abdicating our responsibility to add to the public debate. The argument you always hear from the other side is, well, who's the media to make those decisions? You know, it's the White House or the National Security Agency or the CIA should be making those decisions. But, you know, I think historically and certainly at this very moment, if we relied on them to make those decisions, the vast majority of these stories would not be out there. I mean, you can see that right now in the debate in Washington over the torture report that the administration is debating whether to declassify or not. This is a multi-thousand page report about abuses and illegalities by the CIA after 9/11, and you know, if the media were prevented from having reported on those issues over the years, the public would know next to nothing about it.
When do you and your editors decide when you get that phone call from the government to say, "Hey, thanks for the call. We're running with this anyway"?
There's almost always, or I would say there is always, you know, a lot of debate that goes into it. There will be meetings between reporters and editors, and there's not always agreement. I mean, the biggest case that I was involved in was in 2005 when my partner and I at the paper broke the story about President Bush's warrantless wiretapping program, where they were eavesdropping on Americans without going through the courts. And that was a story that the paper decided to hold at the request of the Bush White House for 13 months. So we as the reporters in that case, and even some of the editors, did not agree with that decision. There's not a uniform mindset. There's often intense debate, and sometimes we come down on different sides. But at the end of the day, the top editors will usually sit down with the administration officials and always hear them out and let them know why or why not we're going to go with the story.
You're an American newspaper based in the United States. Do you only worry about U.S. national security, or if there were a story about a Russian covert agent, say, in Ukraine, do you have that conversation with the Russian government? Does that ever happen?
Less so. I mean, I guess I could imagine a scenario where that might happen, but certainly our main interest is in reporting on U.S. news and keeping in focus the possible fallout as far as American intelligence sources and things like that.
I want to turn to protecting sources before we're done. You as a reporter, or the public might see a whistleblower. The government sees a national security risk. Judith
sure.
Miller of the New York Times was jailed for contempt in one case for not revealing a leaker.
Right.
What's the line there in protecting your sources? You always do it or what?
Well, yeah, I mean that's really our currency is our trust and our word to our sources, and if we fall back on that trust, we don't have much left to go on. Unless there is, it's tough to imagine a scenario where you would break a vow of trust to a source who's been talking to you on a confidential basis. You know, possibly if the source, you know, relying to you or manipulating you in some way, that might sort of negate the original understanding. But short of that, my partner on that original NSA story that I was just talking about is now facing that very situation. His case is before the Supreme Court. He's been looking at a contempt of court citation for a subpoena to disclose a source on a story having to do with a CIA program in Iran, and he has refused to testify, has refused to name that source. So, you know, he may be looking at that same situation. You know, that's the extreme. You know, usually there it gets resolved before that, but you know, too many reporters have been in that situation lately, partly because there is not a so-called shield law at the federal level, which protects the reporter-source relationship. Virtually every state has some version of the shield law, but the federal government, where it's needed most because of national security stories, does not have the equivalent of one, even though folks have been trying for years now to get one.
Eric, enjoy your visit to Wisconsin, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you. I'm sure I will.
That's Eric Lichtblau. He's a reporter at the New York Times. He's speaking Friday on journalism and national security at a conference hosted by UW-Madison's Center for Journalism Ethics.